Welcome to Juice Podcast. I'm Emily Harmon.
Oh, and I'm Gwen Douglas. Welcome to today's episode on the Loire.
So I'm quite excited about this.
I am too.
I'm kind of surprised we haven't done the Loire, actually, because we both...
Me too.
Particularly you. I feel like you've got... You've got quite a lot of...
Yeah, I do, actually.
You know, René Moss, like, you like Chenet.
Yeah, I love Chenet a lot.
Yeah.
It's definitely a go-to for me of...
And your Savvy like... Bee. Love affair. Do, aromatics. Yeah.
Also, our friend Frankie.
Yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
It's the perfect region.
Mm.
Also, I love that we're doing it as a springtime thing because I kind of feel like there's so many great, like, fresh, delicious, zingy springtime
choices
in the Loire.
Yes. 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 Yes, 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 yes.
So we have four today. So we're going to try not to
be wasted.
Yeah.
We'll try to keep our... stuff together.
Right.
And stuff together.
So we're going to start with a little bit of like where the Loire is for those that...
Yes. Yeah. So we know where the Loire is. So we're in northwest France. Brittany's not far by. So basically the closest, I would say the closest town anyway is Tours to...
Yep, sounds about right.
Nantes. No? Tours to Nantes,
yep,
I think. Sounds... is the two ends. Nantes being right by near the sea where all of the wines like Muscadet come from with Melon de Bourgogne. We don't have one today.
We can do that another time.
So we start with the kind of the lower vineyards into the middle, central, and then the upper Loire. So all of the vineyards follow the Loire, all of the vineyards follow the Loire River inland.
Right. Okay. Gotcha. And I'm sure obviously the river plays a part in...
moderating the climate, right. Of course, as well, because it's a very cold place,
right.
Or cool climate to produce wine. And the soils vary depending where you are in the Loire as well.
So we're going to have some limestone.
Yeah, there's a lot of limestone. Like, I mean, particularly in the middle part where you see a lot of Chenin Blanc, for example,
right.
It's very famous for these tufo soils. And then, obviously, when you go further inland towards where we find more of the Sauvignon planted and the Pinot Noir, there's different soils there, rockier soils.
Okay.
We see some flint,
okay.
Silex showing up. Obviously,
yeah, so there was some, like, marine lands, kind of like...
Yes.
Like Chablis has.
Yeah,
sort
these
of
fossilized...
Like,
yeah, and most chalk, anyway, is... I mean, I think all chalk
yes.
is fossilized.
Yes, I think so.
Is fossilized. It's, like, made from animals, essentially.
What? Yeah.
Whether that's algae,
yes, exactly.
or fish, or mammals.
Right.
It's all made from decomposed...
Like the White Cliffs of Dover.
Yes. And the vineyards of Champagne.
Yes, exactly.
Under the layer of trash.
Under the layer of garbaggio.
Under a sweet layer of garbage, yes. But yeah, maybe while we get into this, I might start by pouring the first wine for us so we're not...
So M's picked our lineup today to give us a nice like overview of some interesting producers that we can look at some different grapes and see some iconic producers.
Yeah, I think for some people in the know, they'll know maybe at least one of the producers. Maybe people know all of the producers, but they're all quite small producers.
Yeah, which is cool.
And some of them have like sort of...
cult status.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, here we go. Ooh.
It's all right, Moody. Relax. The dog is again under the table, so be aware.
He is our...
barking might occur.
Yeah, he's our podcast set manager. The agent under the table.
The agent under the table.
Sounds like a scene from The Matrix. There's an agent under the table.
I'm actually really happy you brought a fizz, actually. Because I think you're totally right that this is a region that makes a lot of really nice sparkling...
Well, this is the amazing...
affordable stuff.
Yeah, and this is the amazing thing about the Loire for me is that there is so much diversity in terms of grape variety, soils, regions, stories...
Whilst
producers,
wine styles,
exactly. Sparkling, dry... richer wines, sweet wines.
It's a one-stop shop.
It is, yeah. Maybe not for full-bodied wines so much, but yeah, definitely for fresh wines, young wines, and also wines that age very well as well. We don't have anything old today. That's maybe for another time.
We'll do like a Loire 2.0.
Yes.
Aged Loire.
Lockdown 5, we'll do that.
Yeah. So we've both... I've had this before because of you.
Yeah, I gave you a bottle, right?
Yeah, and it was delicious. It has a really nice scent, actually.
So the wine that we're starting off with is the 2018 Pet Sec Rosé from Le Capriard. And, yeah, I really love this producer. And I think they've sort of been growing in popularity over the years as well. I imported a number of bottles of this into Germany at the beginning, not the beginning of last year, at some time in 2019.
What is time?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I know I've been thinking about that Ravelli book so much lately.
I should read it again, actually.
Like, the right now's time for that, time. Yes. Yeah, just like, what is
time?
Exactly.
I love it.
But yeah. So anyway, so these, what's quite interesting here, two winemakers, Pascal and Moses, and they are making the wine together. They're a small operation, 6.5 hectares. They make 35,000 bottles, so very small production. And they only make Method Ancestral, so they only make Pet Nat. So this is really what they focus their energies on. And they do it excellently, and I think they've really got it down pat. There's always the right level of fizz, the right level of dryness.
The bubbles are nice and clean. It's like not too...
Yeah. And these are natural wines. There's no mousiness at all. And I know in previous years, I remember when I did my pop-up in Superbrick in the motorcycle garage in 2016, I had magnums of these. And a few years before that, there were some of the Pet Nats that had a touch of mousiness to them, but that's not the case, and it hasn't been the case for many years. There is this pristine, crystalline quality in the wines. There's this finesse in the bubble.
The smell is really phenomenal. Yeah. They have a really, like, delicate, fine... There is a little perfumey...
Yes.
Floral.
For me, do you know what this always smells like initially? Jolly Ranchers.
Oh yeah, totally. I can see that.
Like the green and the cherry.
Totally.
Like the green apple flavour and the cherry one.
Oh, I 100% can see that. Yes. Mm. Totally.
So this is actually a blend of...
To cough. excuse me. Tickled my throat.
I'm joking. So this is actually a blend of Cot, which is the local word for Malbec.
Which
you find in the Loire, but it's called Cot, C-O-T. Cot, it's Gamay and Cabernet Franc. So three of the main red grapes in the Loire in this Pet Nat. But yeah.
Yeah, really, I think, what's the price point for this? Like if you buy it from a shop?
If it was in a shop, it would be, depending on the shop's margin, because they are a little bit more expensive than other Pet Nats, but it's because it's an artisan product.
Right, it's delicious.
And they're working organically in quite wet area as well. So the retail price would probably be somewhere between, in euros, 22 to 25.
I mean, that's, I think, in a shop. Reasonable for something like this.
And on a wine list, somewhere between 40 and 50, mm-hmm. depending on the margin.
But I think
it's not like out of the realm of any other Pet Nat.
And I think, like, for what it is, it's really pretty. Anyone would be happy if you had this.
Yes.
Like, celebratory, fun...
Yep.
I would drink this at brunch. Drink this in the middle of the night.
When I can't sleep.
Yeah. I would wear it like perfume.
When those bad dreams come.
No, I think it's like a sparkling for all occasions.
Yes. Yeah, I love this. I love that it's got this dry, like it's dry, but it's fruity.
Yeah, there's like, is there a little residual sugar? Because it does have, it feels like there's a little.
It does, and I think it feels like there's more than there is.
Yeah,
but,
probably.
But I think there is that's like maybe a gram or two, but I don't think it's more than that.
Yeah, very nice.
But I like that there's this kind of little bit of yeasty toast.
Yeah, a little
bit
at the
as
end.
Well.
But otherwise, this seems to be like when I was reading about sparklings in the Loire, that there is this sort of delicacy with some of the, but I haven't had a because there's no Chenin in this, right? It's three red grapes.
Yes,
I did not know that.
Yeah,
the last time I had it.
Yes,
so I should not be drinking blindly. Yeah, cool.
But I think this is interesting, and I think actually just with Pet Nats as well, like, I mean, obviously they've been made all over, but I mean the Loire, there's so many Pet Nats to choose from. There's certain regions where, you know, that it's just a bit more common to see this style of wine, and I think it's also because the Loire, even though you have sort of larger producers, more commercial producers, it's also an area with a high amount of organic vineyards. The natural wine scene, what was happening in Beaujolais was also happening in the Loire at the same time, and it was kind of a revolutionary area, particularly because it's one of the more challenging climates in France to produce wine.
I guess
this
when it's
way,
so
farm
wet, you have a lot of like vineyard issues, molds and bacterial problems, and
so to not use fungicides, for example, you know, it's very tempting to use them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, because this is also an area that, there's botrytis in some wines, right? Mm. because of this.
Some of the sweet wines.
Yeah, some of the sweet wines.
Yeah. So cool. Obviously, it's you have to really be in the vineyards if you're making wines that way.
And I also think it's important that people know that, because I think if you do see that some things cost a little more, but when you see that they're organic certified or they're doing things biodynamically, it tells you already that you have to have some understanding that they go through a little harder time, yes, than someone in the south of France with a 300 days of sun.
Mm.
That when you're battling a maritime climate and a lot of wet, that, yeah, things are coming at you.
Yes, totally.
That take time and money.
And I think while we're talking about the grapes, like, it could be good just to summarize the other grapes that we find. So there's quite a few different grape varieties in the Loire. White, there's Melon de Bourgogne that we've been talking about, which has many names. And then there is Chenin Blanc, Sauvignon, Chardonnay, a little bit of Romorantin, found in Courchevenie. And then the red grapes, we have
Frankie Boy,
Cabernet Franc, we have Pinot Noir, Gamay, Cot, which is Malbec, and then Pinot de Nice and Grollo. And there might be some other things that we've missed off, but they are the
here and there.
They're the key players, let's say.
There's a lot going on. I mean, it must be actually then, I mean, each region, obviously, for appellations will have rules. But then if you're making Vin de France or you're doing some biodynamic stuff, it puts a lot of tools in your tool belt to make interesting stuff if you don't want to have appellations. Are there a lot of winemakers working off?
Yeah, I mean, there's some iconic ones. Like, I mean, look at Thierry Pouzelat, for example. I mean, some of his wines he doesn't...
use any of the...
Some he does use some of the appellations, some he doesn't. And I think, yeah, there's way more freedom around... operating outside the appellation system. But, and I mean, now is a better time than ever to be doing that, because you don't have to rely on the brand. If you've got the right connections and you get the right importers and you go directly to the trade.
And already if you have a name for yourself as a good winemaker, people don't care then if it's like, not a Sancerre or whatever.
I mean, we're talking about small, like in this lineup here anyway, we're talking about quite small producers. Right. So there's a limit anyway to how much they can sell or need to sell.
Okay.
You know?
But this has been a great start, I think. I think it shows that there's like a nice place to look for sparkling if you don't want to be spending champagne money and want something a little different. You know, not everyone likes the flavors in champagne anyway, because sometimes they can be quite savory or buttery or rich or bready or whatever.
Yes.
And sometimes people want something a little more floral or with a little more fruit, something a bit more delicate. So I think there's some of those options maybe in the Loire.
I agree. And I think... for me as well, what I find interesting is not just, one is there's diversity in the wine styles, of course. It's often still a region where you can get good value as well.
Yeah, right.
So like even the expensive wines are like not even expensive compared to other regions. You know, and it was quite interesting. I had a conversation with a sommelier friend in November because I wanted to purchase an expensive bottle of Sauvignon. It was a bottle of Didier Dagano, Silex.
Okay.
And I wanted to buy this wine because I was like, oh, I love this wine. And he said to me, but it's Sauvignon. Why would you spend that much money on a bottle of Sauvignon? And then I was like, but it's like, I mean, it's like the price of a Premier Cru Burgundy. It's not.
And who cares if you like it?
But then I was like, I understand. But then I was like, why have we got these things? You know, like
these like weird ideas of like, oh.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like every other system where you're like passed on these set of ideals and, oh, we see value in this and we see value in this. So there's not value in that. And I don't know, he talked me out of buying it. And then like the whole, like for days after, I was like really ruminating on it. Because I was just like, why did I let somebody talk me out of this?
Out of something that you find delicious, that you enjoy drinking.
Living in a patriarchal world influences you even with your wine buying.
I mean, it's the same idea like when we talk about, when people use the term like basic bitch to describe something. I really hate this term because it's like, it means nothing. Like, there are some wines that are popular because they appeal to lots of people's palates. We all like it. There's nothing wrong about it. There's nothing basic about something being universally delicious or universally great. And if you like it, then fucking roll with it. If you don't, then get off and move on to something else.
Mm.
It's like taking away someone's pleasure for something. It's just shit all around. Like,
I mean, this is also, it goes into a slightly different topic as well of like, this is where I think wine overlaps with art as well, with the idea that value is found in your personal view and value of something, actually.
Yes, it should be.
Of course, there's a level of value to some degree of like quality and, you know, like maybe you're not getting value for money in something, or whatever. But when wines get after a certain price point, that's when it does become like buying fine art. Like, okay,
is that
piece of cardboard that's like just glued onto a piece of canvas?
But I think it's also the motivation of why someone is buying it, because, you know, there are some art buyers that buy unusual pieces of art because it speaks to them, because they enjoy it.
And that's what I mean with the wine. Yeah,
some people are buying wine because they love it and enjoy it, and other people are buying it as, like, speculatory, like an investment. Like, oh, if I buy this, I don't understand it or like it, but I think this artist is going to be really famous in X number of years and I can sell it for a lot of money. And people do this with wine all the time. Mm. So it's like... yeah, the motivation behind why someone even purchased something is also important. Are you buying it because you just love it? Then fucking buy it. If you have the money and it's, you know, you can obviously wait around till it gets a little cheaper and it's nice to ask people if it's, you know, if it's going to go down in price. The same as in art. But I think if you're buying something that you enjoy, only you can make the decision if it's worth it.
100%. And I mean, it's interesting this as well with wine, like just staying on this sort of art topic as well, especially with the secondary market.
I was about to say the secondary market is like,
yeah, I mean, like, look at like what's happening with producers like Miroir, for example. I mean, it's kind of disgusting. Like, I mean, 1,000 euros for
and
a wine.
It's out of control, because we bought a bottle of Miroir in Amsterdam for like from a restaurant for like $65.
Yes.
You know, a few years ago. Like, even on the list, it was like listed for 65.
Mm.
So it's like astounding to me to see, because you know the winemaker's not seeing that secondary market money and like never does.
And I've seen this, I've actually seen winemakers starting to bypass the secondary market because they're getting sick of it. So there's a Spanish producer that I know quite well that are friends of mine, and their top wine, they literally tripled the price of it because they were selling it.
Yeah, and then
it was being sold for that price by other people. Yes. So they were like, do you know what?
Then we sell it.
Yeah, like it's not going to any restaurant, so we're just going to sell it this price and people can just pay for it directly through us.
Because otherwise, for me, it makes like, it's really unfair then that the middleman makes a lot of money and the actual person that's producing and crafting this beautiful thing gets nothing or very little, you know? Oh, you should be happy that your wine is a cult wine. It's like, yeah, who gives a shit? If I'm still selling the wine for $15 a bottle, who gives a shit if it's being sold for $700 on the secondary market?
Yes.
I don't see it.
Yes.
It's not.
Yeah, I think that's also the... that's also where it becomes, the view is skewed for the consumer, right? Because of it looks as though they're doing really well, but it's actually not the case.
It's the same with art. When you see things like, you see, you know... up-and-coming artists sold at, you know, art sold at Christie's for,
totally.
Like, millions, and you're like, that artist was probably paid, like, 10 grand for that piece.
I mean, I don't know if you saw, like, with the scandal with, like, Dave Chappelle, the American comedian. I think he's from New York, actually.
He's admired in a lot of...
Huh?
Like, the comedian.
Yeah, Chappelle. Do you know Dave Chappelle?
Yeah, of course.
He's so funny. And, so recently, was it a couple of years ago, but fairly recently, he was scheduled to do, like, some stand-up, I think it was a 20-minute segment or something, and instead of doing the comedy, he was like, hey, so just letting you know, like, by the way, I'm an everyday person, and he talks about the complexities of, like, contracts and all of the intricacies that are written in there and how you sign contracts as an artist because you're desperate that you just take this and then
you have no power anymore.
So basically his show was being streamed on Comedy Central and I think HBO, and he was receiving no money for it and they could keep streaming it.
I mean, this happens
without his consent.
This happens so much with, like, you know, I had it with like Top Chef Canada forever, you know, like the message, and because a contestant had tattoos of mine, but they send you a contract that gives you a blanket where they can have control over your artwork in any form. Like, that's the contract they make you want to sign. And I was like,
yeah. And even apparently even in the contract, it says like, even in the universe, you know, like,
yeah, basically,
like, all these
yeah.
ridiculous
in case
things.
We move to Mars.
Yeah. No one will be able to buy
yeah.
it.
Yeah. It's kind of like, and I think as an artist or as a small wine producer, any of these things, you have to really be on top of this stuff because it's really easy.
But you can't, in some cases, you can't afford a lawyer. Like, he didn't.
No, totally.
And now he's tied. So he did this whole, like, it was really an act of protest where he just said, this is the only choice we have. He's like, if you support me, he's like, don't watch my show. Everybody needs to boycott the show. So the droppings, like the listing.
Right, to drop the listing.
The viewers, it drops. So then... it actually has an impact onto that channel.
unfortunately.
And it was quite interesting. You talked, then I saw another one because I was like, oh, I want to know more about this. And Netflix actually had been streaming it, and he wrote to them and said, like, this is going on, and they just removed it. And then they paid him. And I thought that was actually quite.
And
like,
then it bombed. But then that's
no.
And then he made too many trans jokes and he lost me as a viewer.
Dude, but, oh no.
But he has a, yeah, this stuff is super interesting, the contract stuff, because it's, this is how secondary market and so many things fucks everybody. And I think we touched on this on the last episode when you said about being mindful of where you put your money. And I think, like, yes, this is a topic 100%. Don't buy your shit on the secondary market. Mm. Buy it from someone who's like, either has like direct contact with the, you know, you could go visit a lot of these places, I think, right? Like,
I would say be really cautious. Also be really, I mean, for me as well, I don't buy anything on the secondary market because I'm not dealing so much in the fine wine end anyway. So I'm not buying, from like, auction and things so often. But if I did, there'd be ways to do it at least. Sure. With a bit more consideration or through direct sellers or whatever. But
also because it's just wasted money. That's the thing that makes me bananas, because that money, that's, it's just like someone making that money for like very, it's a really strange for me way to make money as someone who creates things for a living.
What do you mean? Sorry.
Like the person making all that money. I don't know. For me, it's like a really exploitive business.
Yeah, it's very exploitative. Totally.
Like the choice to be in this business and to, I mean, it's a, I mean, we live in a capitalist world, so that's part of the thing, but I would rather see that money. Imagine if so much of that secondary market money went back into wineries where they could, where more wineries could go biodynamic or work a bit hard, you know, just better, easier.
Yes. I mean, or that winemaker could take his family on holiday.
Right. Take a break. You know, the winemakers work so hard. People forget that, like, when their wines are sold for hundreds and hundreds on the secondary market, they think they're fancy. These people are farmers, you know, like who make beautiful things and who appreciate fine things, but not in the same.
I think it's also to be cautious just as a buyer anyway, is
of
that
all things
that one, there's that impact and it's important to be aware of that impact. But two, you might actually be buying counterfeit wine.
Yeah, totally.
So,
and also, I mean, very the easy. Environmental impact. You know, I remember seeing a bottle in the Hof, say, at the tattoo shop that someone had bought a couple of nice Premier Cru, whatever.
Yeah.
But they were bought from a wine shop in America. They had a label on it. So it's like, these wines went from the winery in France to obviously someone then in the States who then, you know, it's like, it just went back and forth and back and forth. It's like, we also don't need this shit to be traveling so far back and forth to go from Europe to the States back to Europe. That's a journey.
It is a journey.
That it didn't need to necessarily
maybe it was
go
made,
on.
Maybe it was a blend made by old mate. What's his name? Randy. Who's the guy that did the, where he was making all the counterfeit wine in his apartment?
Oh, yeah. That was what kind was that of amazing. It was great. Sour grapes.
Sour grapes. Yeah. It's kind of amazing, wasn't it? I kind of was, in some ways.
Well, I wonder how you want to high-five him for being so good at
it. It's incredulous. It's just like, how's he getting away with this? But then you're also like, come on, man. Check the lot numbers. Like,
research. It actually shows you actually how much there's an element of trust in this. And also, people don't challenge each other because there's a lot of ego tied into wines.
Well, and there's not enough education actually done around like sourcing wine and how to source wine.
It's easy to fleece people.
Yeah, and I mean, I see this even I see this in a very basic level, just even with how sommeliers purchase, wine shops purchase, online wine shops purchase, that there are ethics and values in place and systems in place that need to be respected for this to work in. With respect to the winemaker, to everybody that does all of the work to promote, to build up the profile of those wineries, that I'm always really cautious around how I buy and who I buy from and in the way in which I buy from them. And I think that's not considered enough today because everybody looks for the quick fix. Right. And how can I get that wine for the cheapest price and da-da-da. And there's no thought of like, why
sustainability.
Yeah, totally. I mean,
for everybody.
Yes. Right. And it's like,
it's not just what can you squeeze out of something, how can you squeeze as much out of something, but then if you do that, you kill it.
Yes.
Sometimes there has to be like...
Well, I'm a big believer of karma and I know it all comes around. Yeah. It all comes out in the wash in some way because it's not a sustainable model. And I do think overall, there are more people fighting the good fight.
Right. It just gets more and more as...
Yeah.
This goes on.
But it's just being aware. So for anybody that is listening, that is looking to buy online, like if you're buying anything expensive that has a number or a lot number on the wine, contact the winery, check the lot number, because it could be a case that wine has been stolen. There's been a lot of wine crime happening within restaurants.
Yes, actually.
A lot of burglaries. There was one recently somewhere in Germany. And I mean,
these are some serious heists going down. And they're like,
I mean, this is like, I mean, it's not jewelry thieves anymore. It's like fine wine thieves. So,
but it's the same idea where you have people with money, like, and weapons and like,
it's like,
and they're
really
clever.
Planned.
These are like art heists, basically.
So, exactly. Yeah. So it's really important to anything that you see. Also, you have to wonder sometimes, why do I have access to these things so easily? You know, like,
there's
a reason why something might look like an appealing price.
If it's too good to be true, it generally is.
Yes.
Yeah. Just to question a little bit, do a little research.
Yeah, question, contact, and always contact the winery. So you can always say, I'm purchasing this. This is the name of the seller. I want to check. Because fine wine buyers will register the lot numbers. There's a traceability with that for some of the fine wines.
There'll be a sort of like...
history.
Yeah, exactly. They'll be like, oh, this person makes sense because they're in contact with this person.
Yeah, and if somebody's been like, you know, say someone's tote like hundreds of thousands of euros of wine is stolen, let's say DRC, for example.
Yeah, right.
Then they're going to contact the winery, they're going to let them know.
Yeah,
right?
Totally.
So then there's this dialogue.
And,
so
and actually it's important for them because the winery also wants to be on top of what's going on for for their brand.
Yeah.
So we're just like drinking this wine right now.
Yeah, so sorry.
Because it's delicious.
Meanwhile, our conversation, we have...
quite a big jump in terms of style.
Texture, right?
And texture, yeah. This was a...
So this is 2006. This is, I don't know why, that reminds me of Donald Trump. It doesn't do that. Because I think as well, because I imagine him doing... anyway, it's going somewhere really wrong.
All right.
Oh my God. I'm so glad no one is... don't, anyway. So, Gérard Boulay, Mondam, Sancerre, or Sancerre Mondam 2016, which Gwen
picked up.
Which is great.
I basically did like a CrossFit where I walked like a case of wine an hour across town. So that made me feel good about it.
Nothing else to do these corona days.
eight kilometers with a case of wine on my back.
Oh.
It's good. Getting stronger by the day. because they're sold. So I picked this one and the last one up at Passion Vin here in Berlin.
Okay. So yeah, so we have wine from Sancerre. So probably the most famous... appellation within the Loire, and there's quite a lot of different appellations in the Loire. So Sancerre is always 100%. Actually, no, I was about to go in there with a bit of a weird fact. So if it's a white wine from Sancerre, it's always 100% Sauvignon. But there is red wine produced, which is made with Pinot Noir. And a little fun fact about this: so historically, Sancerre was a red wine appellation.
Oh, really?
Don't know if you got this in your homework, but not ringing any bells.
It's just to make me look like a news reporter.
I'm sorry, miss. Yeah. Historically it was a red wine appellation where it was Pinot Noir that was planted.
I did not know that.
And then after Phylloxera and the success of Bordeaux wines, Sauvignon was planted there.
Interesting.
Sauvignon comes originally from Bordeaux. Right. And so there we go. And I mean, Cabernet Franc also down there. I mean, Cabernet Sauvignon, the two parents of Cabernet Sauvignon are Cabernet Franc and Sauvignon Blanc.
The family.
So they're all kind of, and I don't know, I'm not sure what instigated Sauvignon being planted there, but it was planted there.
Interesting.
And now it kind of has taken over a lot of the vineyards. But there are some good producers still producing Pinot Noir today, but it is really like a minority. Of course, you know, that people know when they see Sancerre that they think...
white wine.
Sauvignon,
right. Which is, I mean, popular. I would say, like, most average people probably know...
Sancerre.
That they like Sancerre. They may not know that it's Sauvignon, but they'll be like, I've had that one and that one's delicious.
Yes. So Sancerre, I mean, beautiful, diverse soils. This is where we see different soil types. We have these sort of rockier soils. We see flint showing up as well. We see the limestone as well, some marl. And Gérard Boulay up there with, in the more sort of classic profile, like classic tasting profile wines, I would say there's sort of two producers that are really kind of iconic. And I would say Gérard Boulay and I'd say Francois Cottard
as
well.
Okay, doing the
two. But yeah, so, I mean, again, it's not a huge estate. It's 11 hectares based around the town of Chavignol, which is also very famous for goat's cheese. And all
which
of the
vineyards pairs well with Sauvignon Blanc. Yes.
They say the chalkiness from the soil goes with the chalkiness of the cheese. I don't know, but it does work.
And what's that bloody expression that's like chalk and cheese?
Maybe that's where it came from.
I don't know.
Like chalk cheese and wine.
Chalk cheese and wine.
Yeah. But yeah, all the vineyards are quite old. They're starting from about 45 years of age. So he's got older vines. I know there's no herbicides, fungicides, pesticides used. I think lower levels of sulfur. The yields in general are about a quarter lower than any other producer in the Loire as well. So he's really focused on quality over quantity and making these really beautiful expressions of the grape.
Yeah, I mean, this is really delicious.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And I mean, this is also what's interesting for me, which I think there's not enough conversation around, because it had been so hyped and so, like, such a vibe to be saying Sauvignon isn't cool, as we've talked about a lot with the Covert stuff, yes, which I'm still not convinced by, but with Sauvignon it's slightly different. But that's just my taste.
Yeah, I also think because Sauvignon can wear, it can be so many different, it can express itself so many different ways. I think that's the, like, I mean, I remember even just taking my first wine classes, and I mean, when you really are a noob and you know nothing, being like, I didn't know it was Sauvignon Blanc. And that explains probably why I liked it. Because, of course, for starting out, the New Zealand Sauvignons are so delicious. You're kind of led that way. And then you get more interested and you're like, oh, the cooler climates have a totally different flavor profile.
Yes.
And it feels like a completely different product.
Yes.
So it's like really interesting that actually it's not just for suburban moms.
It's not. In this case, it's really not. And I think, yeah, this is a wine, like, I mean, it's coming up to 5 years of age, so it is developing. It's still got some lovely youthful, like, things, but the honey, Richard creamier notes are coming through.
It even has, I mean, maybe I'm using the wrong word, but it feels like that sort of petrol-y, like...
I know what you mean, yeah. I think that's this kind of flinty kind of...
Yeah, it might be, because I was like, maybe it's the wrong word for it, but...
You know, like the, like this kind of struck...
Yeah, and like flinty.
And then it also gives this kind of a slightly different floral profile as well, because it's not going into that, like, elderflower bomb that you see sometimes. It's almost like going more into, like, white flowers, let's say.
Totally. But it has a really beautiful smell.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah, I like this a lot.
Texture. It's lovely, fine mineral acidity. Lures you back.
Fine.
What do you think of this? Food pairings? That's usually your question.
Yeah, I don't know. I actually think this is maybe more versatile than it... Like, I think I would drink this by itself, happily. I think... I don't know. There's something... I kind of want to...
I want a creamy sauce and pastry, and it could be with chicken or it could be with fish.
Fish. I was going to say, like a fish mornay. Like a fish pie, Claude Mornay, like this kind of like cream sauce, butter. Because it can go... That's why I was like, I think it's actually pretty versatile.
Imagine a fish... Oh, I wish we had
even
a fish
pasta
pie
would be great with a creamy pasta.
Yes. Or even like a seafood risotto with lots of parmesan on top.
Yeah. So I think there's like enough fattiness going on that like...
Yeah. Mamma mia, that's a good wine. The length on that is amazing.
Really delicious.
I also think this style of sancerre, where it's more complex, it can handle... more richer foods, because everybody, you know, you read these wine books about wine, food and wine pairing, and they're so sterile in some ways.
Yeah, it's always the same shit too. It's like Sauvignon,
yes,
goat cheese,
yes.
It's
goat cheese, and I was thinking the whole like Sauvignon and asparagus.
Actually, didn't even cross my mind.
I mean, especially here in Germany, we have like six, when Spargelzeit happens, when it's asparagus season.
The Dutch are also into this too.
6 months of overcooked asparagus. Someone else said that, do they love asparagus so much? And then you just get like wet asparagus.
Like a floopy, wet noodle asparagus. It's like,
I can buy tinned asparagus.
Flaccid asparagus.
Yeah.
Oh, tinned asparagus. That's like a throwback to the 80s. Like a,
I thought you might be down with that. Wrapped in some ham.
I mean,
the cheesy sauce over the top.
No. Like an asparagus. Mm. Yeah, fish pie. That's like, I was thinking cod mornay, same thing, mashed potato, cream sauce, fish.
Yeah. I mean, put the boat out, like have a lobster mornay maybe.
Yum. Yeah,
some mashed
good.
Potato. Yeah, comfort food in some ways would be interesting, just because of... Also, like... having something that's kind of like that, that's like a fish pie is kind of like a working class dish, right? And then to have something sophisticated like this.
It just made me laugh because...
Boil in the bag cod.
Because we had kind of one of these, like I talked about it the last episode, that we had a Burgundy night a few weeks ago. And then it was this like, Luki and I had instant ramen for dinner. I mean, he put sea urchin in his, so it was a bit of a fancy instant ramen. But then it was like instant ramen and a bottle of Burgundy. Fuck it. Pair it with whatever you want. Like, have a fancy bottle, have a working class meal. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes they go well. Because we forget that people, like, the wine is also rustic, you know? Mm. People drink it. The people from there drink it with their everyday meals. Mm. I don't think it's so far removed to think, like, some fish and taters.
No, it'd be amazing.
It'd be so good.
Mm.
Best of all the worlds.
I've been eating quite a lot of, whenever I cook, like, potatoes, if I bake them or whatever, like, little ones. No, so like almost like buttery, like, but not just buttery because they've been cooked in butter, but like the texture of the inside's right. Buttery.
I guess it depends on the...
And you know when they're like left over the next day? Mm. I like reheat them up and then I put them in bread and I eat them like that. Carbs on carbs. It's like the best thing ever.
It's like I brought her a Danish a couple of weeks ago that was like...
Oh my God, that was it. I told you this already, right? From when you Albatross. Gave me the Danish and I was like, carbs on carbs.
It was like...
So good.
Potato gratin inside a Danish.
Yeah, carbs on carbs is only better if there's... Dairy and carbs on carbs.
This is like cheese and potato inside a Danish. Yes. So shout out to Albatross Bakery here in Berlin because they make some the good shit.
Yeah, maybe we should do a...
I mean, we're fueled on it right now. We ate from there today, so they make amazing stuff. All right. We're like...
Next one, I know.
Just gabbing away.
We're back. I was a bit out of sorts when we recorded last time. I was like really... out of practice with being in front of the camera.
But now the drinking is socializing. I know. It's like people... Every time I've seen people, I've had to like apologize for my awkwardness because I feel like I'm not quite there yet. Back up to practicing.
I just want to say as well, I feel the same way. And number two, that wine that we just had so is good. Spectacular. Yeah, like, because really the delicious. Chalkiness is starting to come through in that wine at the end. Like, you can really taste
it's
the soil.
It lasts forever.
Mamma mia.
Really good.
Bonissimo. So, number three. We're on 2018. Richard Leroy. Wow. La Nouvelle Holy de Montbenot. Is that how you say Montbenot?
Yeah, Montbenot.
Montbenot. So, bit of an icon, this wine. Very small producer, Richard Leroy, 2.7 hectares, so it's almost microscopic actually in terms of production. Bit of a character. I don't know why I was about to say bit of a vagabond. I just wanted to use that word, but
like somebody just imagined like with a jaunty little stick and a red kerchief on the end of it.
I wanted to say it, and I was like, and then I literally said to myself, that's not an appropriate word.
No.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, bit of a character, and I think a guy that really is sort of seeking—I wouldn't say seeking perfection, but seeking the truest expression. Yeah. Yes, authenticity in what he's doing, and somebody that's willing to do all the experiments to really find where that is. And I know you were saying when you were reading up about him about you know how his approach to barrels and this kind of very rigorous. Yeah, experimentation like, yes. To find exactly the formula that works for him and his
wines. I read that he called himself a tasting freak who can taste exactly the wood used in wines. So it's like he obviously has a very developed palate and...
Very finely tuned.
Yeah, finely tuned, sensitive. So, yeah. This I love that like so far every wine we've tried, like the scent on this is... completely different to the other two scents. This is really like powerful.
So for our listeners that don't know these wines, it's a 100% Chenin Blanc, and for people who kind of know the winery or sort of in the natural wine world kind of know that these wines have like a cult status because the quantity is so low. I mean, I got three bottles. The allocation was three bottles for this year. Still not quite sure why we didn't get more of that. Ooh. But
why? It gives you a pucker.
But yeah, so one of them has been used for today for the podcast.
Wow.
But yeah, for me, this is a very true expression of Chenin Blanc. So Chenin always has this very racy acidity. Yeah. We've talked about Chenin quite a bit on the podcast, but this nervousness, but then also the width, right? The breadth and the intense. And
that's why it makes it such an an interesting grape, because it can be this like super acidic, like unapproachable kind of bland, weird wine, and then on the other side of the spectrum be this big honey, like rich kind of stuff going on. So it's like a...
And I mean, this one's 14% alcohol as well.
This is a banger. This is a firecracker. Yeah.
And this is amazing because it's 14%, but the acidity is still feels so high that you don't even feel the heat from the alcohol. It's shocking.
For those North American listeners, like I feel like the cheek taste is like Welch's grape juice, where you get this like, you know, Welch's grape juice is a grape juice that's like sold as being like the taste you can feel in your cheeks.
Mm.
So this gives me that same like, like this pow, tanginess. You feel it like in your cheeks. Like it really, because I think the scent is much rounder and sort of honeyed. And then you take the sip and you're like, woo.
Yes.
It like catches you a little off guard. It's really
beautiful.
Fun. Yeah.
And I couldn't find the total production for this vintage, but the previous vintage, there were 400 bottles produced.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, I don't feel so bad about my your three.
No, that's actually pretty bottles. Good.
It's like less than two. I think it's less than two barrels. So, yeah, I thought.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What a, I mean.
I love Chenin so much.
Me too. Because I know you also like South African wine a lot. Yeah. And then there's some great versions of it there. But this, I'm trying to think, like, I mean, I also would drink this by itself. Basically, everything we've had so far could be a standalone.
Mm.
Happily drink them
just
with friends. They actually don't need something else. But I don't know. This is a tricky one for food.
I think I could imagine you and I sitting here and just drinking a bottle of this and not thinking about it. But maybe for the everyday person, because the acidity is quite high.
Like I would do like a risotto or something. You need something like
to
give you some
cushioning.
Yeah.
Cushioning, yeah.
So maybe,
do you know what I think? I was going a bit of in another direction. Fondue.
Because
something's cut through something fatty.
Interesting.
And the creaminess, not for you. What would you have with fondue? Maybe we should do a little fondue episode.
Yeah, we should do, actually. Because
I have a fondue set at home as well.
It's tough with fondue.
Maybe we'll do that when we do our Swiss wines.
And yeah, we do
we've got one coming up.
Mm-hmm. I like fondue a lot. Yeah, but I can see... I mean, I guess... I'm always, like, tough with eating with fondue and drinking anything too cold.
You have to drink acidic wine.
But they tell you...
You drink water, then you get the cheese ball.
But isn't that funny? Because isn't so much Swiss wine, so, like, a lot of it has very low alcohol, like Chasselas and stuff.
But
or low acidity, sorry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Chasselas is quite, like, low.
It's true.
So curious. But I mean, I would eat cheese fondue and have cheese dreams anytime.
What about raclette then?
Yeah, I mean,
what would you have with this?
I don't know, that's why I'm struggling.
Yeah,
I'm struggling a bit, actually, what I would eat with this. Because I definitely would need to eat something to put a base on it, because the acidity is quite high. And as I'm getting older, acidity hits me harder. I have a harder time.
It hits me in the pit.
Yeah, I don't know, this
stomach
is a
lining's been worn away.
Yeah, basically.
It's wearing it's thin, like, guys. Yeah.
It's like a used Kleenex just falling apart.
Yeah, but what about even things like, I don't know, a chestnut soup, for example.
Ooh, that sounds good. Also, the chestnutty, I can see that being delicious.
What about pizza?
A Bianca pizza.
Like with potato and rosemary.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
Well, yeah, that
carbs.
Sounds good. Carbs on carbs. Yeah, potato on bread. That sounds good.
Mm.
I think like I wouldn't put... I think with this particular... Maybe like not with all Chenin, but this particular one, I think it could... Because it's so like expressive on its own. Maybe it doesn't need anything so...
Maybe sushi.
Maybe... But that's why I like the potato thing, because it's like...
Yeah.
A potato with rosemary, that's like enough to... You can still taste this and let it have its own thing. Yeah, I'm going to think on that.
It's lovely, though. The more that this wine open, you start to get different layers, right? So initially you get the acidity, you get this sort of trademark, like bruised apple-y, orchard fruit kind of tone to the wine. And then like again this kind of little bit of nuttiness as well, and it's just totally. That nuttiness is now coming into like a touch of toastiness,
maybe a tart. I don't know. I'm like,
maybe it's just that albatross dauphinoise or whatever, that yeah. potato gratin.
I just think it, like, I would put something simple with this, actually.
That's breast not chicken, too, like a roasted yeah. corn-fed chicken or something.
I just think when I think...
with garlic aioli or something, like...
that can stand up to it, but isn't, like... I kind of, like, think of simple stuff with this. Mm. Because I think it's so nice on its own. Like, doesn't need something powerful to, like, overshadow it.
Mm. There's like a St. John recipe for poached chicken, which is quite delicious.
I'm getting hungry now.
Me too. I'd love it. I mean, it would be great if there was like a rotisserie chicken. Maybe that's it.
Right here.
That's it. A rotisserie chicken.
I mean, I'll eat a rotisserie chicken
with
any
your fingers. Yeah.
No.
There is a restaurant actually, not far from Aura. It just does chicken, but
just the chicken. Mm. Mm, this was really delicious. I'm going to think about that for the food. By myself. Later at home. I'll be like, So that was good. Lovely.
Mm. I think for people who are looking to try Loire Valley Chenin, they could look at appellations like Vouvray, for example. Right. It's always still, you can find good value in Vouvray. Mont-Louis as well is an appellation that's slowly building up. There's a producer called Francois Chidane. I think you would have tried the wines there at Passy and Van. Vouvray, Samur as well.
Yes, I was looking up a little of Samur.
Yes, some very, very nice wines being produced there. And Savigny, obviously, which is also iconic. Right. Which is what Nicolas Joly. I was actually toying around with maybe bringing that wine today, the Cullet des Serrons.
We have enough on our plate right now.
Was that a FOMO gaze?
I was like, Yeah. But I think after this on a hungry belly right now, it's gonna be maybe it's good four. Five might have been the tipping point a little
bit.
But this is really delicious. You're saying like these are a small allocate, like there aren't a lot of bottles. So I'm guessing that retail wise this is not something people are gonna be able to find. Retail?
I don't think it's that cheap, because I think if it was retail.
So this is more something people should be looking for on wine lists.
Yeah, you can find it on wine lists if you see it. You might find it in wine shops. So if you find it, you might buy it.
Yes.
It's a wine that, like, there's no appellation. This is another example, Val de France, right? Like, there's no appellation on this wine as well. But yeah, if you see it, I suggest you try it, obviously. I mean, for us, like, if we sell wines cheaper than other restaurants here. Right. If we were to see this on another wine list, it'd be about 110, 120 euros. So we would sell this here at Aura maybe for 90 or something.
Yeah. I think good value for what you're getting. This is really exceptional.
Yeah. Yes.
It's big and bold. I like it.
But, you know, 80 euros now, like 80 to 90 euros, like, which is where we'd sell it, is like, pay that for a Chablis now.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's like kind of...
it's in line.
Right. It's delicious. Mm. I know it's one of those that I don't want to tip away because it feels like a waste.
Tip your water away and then put it in your water glass and you can drink it after.
Yeah. Maybe take a sip of water too.
Hydrate Harmon. That's what my friend Jan always says to me. He's like, hydrate Harmon, because he watches me and I don't drink any water.
I know, I'm also like becoming this person that like forces people to drink water at the house now.
Yeah. Why? Because like, your guests are getting a bit unruly. I see you getting unruly in my
not
bed.
Not drinking water. No, it's more like you're going to feel
go
like
home
shit
and feel
tomorrow.
Good the next day.
Yeah, it's like, I also know this for myself, like forcing myself, putting lots of bottles of water on the table means that someone is going to force you to drink more water. And it solves a lot of problems. People forget that drinking water is like, I've been a lifelong insomniac, and one of the major causes of insomnia is
booze.
Dehydration.
Oh, I was like, booze.
Dehydration.
I'm like, the answer to every question is booze.
Yeah, but actually, like, that's the thing, because it makes your heart race a little bit more, so you have a hard time falling asleep. So if you are an insomniac, the number one thing you can do for yourself is just drink more water, and then you can figure out the other shit.
And if you're hungover and not able to sleep, maybe you should drink some water.
Have some water.
Not booze. Booze is not the answer.
No. Hair of the dog
water
only works
the
for
answer.
A little amount of time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because if you apply that theory to, if you apply that theory to a hangover, you could just be, I mean, you'd be like with Nan and I.
Yeah. You'd be covered in deep heat A535. And you'd be doused in lavender. And
Uncle Monty would be making moves on you in the evening. You have too many sherries. So
to the shapes of these glasses of Fender palettes.
I know.
Oh, I love that film so much. Yeah. Such a good film.
So we're on to Wine 4. We've made it to the end, almost.
This also is like, I mean...
Beautiful.
Totally different smell. Like, again on another... And you know what's really funny is actually like... Considering this is a northern wine, there are some things that bring me somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Because of... Yeah, there's a little...
So for everyone tuning in, we're now drinking 2018 Samuel Champigny from Thierry Germain, which is... Yeah, I was just saying to Gwen before we started recording today, actually, that this is a wine that I've listed on quite a lot of wine lists. And yeah, I'm quite fond of it because it's not not crazy expensive.
No, it's really good value. I think I paid 15 to 17 euros.
Yes.
It was less than 20.
Okay. Yeah.
Like, I thought, wow, this is a really good value.
But typical, so it's 100% Cabernet Franc, because Samuel Champigny is. And I love this. It's on the nose. You get this raspberry, violet, this perfume. So maybe it's the wine that smells of space, maybe. But then it's herbaceous, so it almost smells like the full raspberry bush with all the leaves and all the thorns and all the...
And a bit of jalapeno and some red paprika.
Exactly,
and like...
totally. Exactly. Yeah, black, like this lovely bit of black fruit, but then also this, you're right, this kind of slightly vegetal note. Earthiness, like a touch of truffle.
Let's have these with the tamales.
This would be great with some Mexican tamales. Gwen's partner's been making a Mexican storm here in Berlin.
The Austrian making tamales. Yes. But I would actually, now I'm sad I didn't have a bottle of this when we had tamales at home, because I think this would be amazing.
With the beans as well.
Yes,
I don't know why,
there's
but
something,
I'm just like, oh, just make the beans. Yeah.
Because I think there's something like very smooth about this. It's so like live.
Crunchy. There's these tannins, but they're like,
but it's
they're
not...
fine, but they're kind of dusty at the same time.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like,
They're fine and dusty, but there's quite a few of them.
Yeah, also very easy drinking.
For me, when you taste this, it reminds me of like when you see these old black and white photographs where they don't have as many pixels in as like the current day ones.
Right.
So there's like
a fuzz around the edge.
Yeah, or just like, well, not even just on the edge, just like the whole thing. Like there's this
softness.
Kind of, yeah.
Like the Vaseline sort of like soft focus.
Yes.
Easy drinking. Like it has tannins, but it's not like...
No, they just come through, but they come through in this kind of like
gentle,
almost a lemony kind of way as well, where they're kind of acidic and fresh. Epic.
Like this little smokiness. I would drink this with goulash also.
I see what you mean. Yeah, like a stew or a schnitzel or something.
Yeah, because it's like, oh, I was thinking the goulash because of the sort of like that like red pepper base. This has given me a little like paprika vibes.
Yeah,
because there's a little tiny like not smokiness, but almost smokiness. I would smash this with some goulash.
I think you're right. I mean, goulash is not something, I mean, I've eaten it like maybe once or twice in my whole life. But I think you're right,
I'm
like casserole or something.
Yeah, I'm thinking of like
oxtail.
Like that Austrian goulash, and you eat it with like the semmel bun after, or like eat all the sauce up, and it's all made with red pepper and beef, and it's kind of sweet,
really
but kind
good.
Of savory.
Yeah.
And yum. This is really good. Also, I love what... Yes, totally.
Chili
I actually just made an amazing chili last week.
When you had chili con carne, did your mum used to make it with rice as well?
Yeah, always. I mean, British.
I know, it's so funny.
It's
really
so
white
England.
Rice as well.
Really white, like glowing white.
And like, no one's added any salt to it. It's just like this sweet, overcooked rice.
I think my
rice.
Mom even serves it with like basmati rice.
I think
for
mine,
a total mindfuck. With
I
cheddar
think
on
mine
top.
Does, yes. Yeah. And cheddar. Cheddar that's grated, but through the biggest holes possible.
Yes.
On the grater.
Oh, yeah,
right? So
100%.
Jesus.
Otherwise, it crumbles. I'm a big cheddar fan. But I actually made
but
chili.
But there's no microplane in the English kitchen.
No. It's what side of the four... I mean, I still have one of those. Lucas looks at it with disdain every time it comes out of the cupboard.
But it's always the big one, also on the big side, because you know.
Cheddar will crumble if you try to... We have a microplane at home. you do that and you just end up with like 8 pieces of cheddar in your hand.
I think it's that, and then I think it's also like the housewife, the housefrau, the mama who's like at home.
I'm not cleaning that motherfucking tiny thing.
She's like, yeah, one, but I mean those really tiny those holes. Ones are horrible. You need like a toothbrush to get in there.
Exactly.
So there's that, and then it's like, how can I grate this cheese as quick as I can just to get dinner? Just big chunks. Like, I'm just, yeah, I'm
if
just
they gonna... could, they would just crumble it with their bare hands and sprinkle it.
Yeah, they would. I mean, I there was a stage where I'd never grate it at home, so I just used to take a knife and just slice it really thinly me off.
Yeah, why not? Like Italian style. With the parmesan. Yes. Just sort of chunks.
Flakes. Yeah, flakes. They are. They're like, I don't even know what, yeah, they're like thin slices.
Thin slices. The Dutch like that too, the cheese slicer. I have a Dutch cheese slicer. But yeah, chili. I made some chili recently with the tomatoes from our balcony because we'd frozen them from last spring. So I made chili with the tomato base from my own balcony. We did, I made like a chipotle and black bean. Fucking delicious. God, I love chili. But now, next time I know, I'm going to get a bottle of this.
Chili and Frankie.
So good.
Chili and Frankie.
Not Frankie and Grace. Frankie and
Bloody
Chili.
Hell, that's a brilliant...
Such a good show.
Oh, my God. There's
I'm really sad it's over.
Is it finished? I thought there was another series coming.
I don't know. I hope so.
I think there'll be another series. I mean, Jane Fonda.
It's both ridiculous. Of them. Lily Tomlin.
No, they're both amazing for different reasons. But you just look at Jane Fonda and you're like, how are you in your 80s? Like, she's so, like, her art, like, everything. Just like, I mean, I know she's like Mrs. Aerobics or whatever. Right. But still. But it's
such a good show.
And what I love about it is, like, I don't know, I looked at the two of them.
Gave me hope, actually. That whole show gave me hope actually, about life as I get older.
It needed to happen because everyone was like, oh, you get old, it's going to be like this. And it's like, actually, no, you don't. You're just like a human person.
You're still you. You
still have all the same wants and needs.
Sometimes you might break a hip if you fall down.
So
you're still going to be you. Like, you'll still be you when you're 80.
Yeah.
And I'll be me. So it'll be, it's like... I think it just gave me so much hope and humor to look at these like two phenomenal women.
And also to like acknowledge that they are still phenomenal. Like that was for me the most powerful part of it. And
I'm happy I got pushed into watching it because I probably wouldn't have chosen it.
I mean,
I binged it.
I've rewatched it every time. Just like, they're so amazing. And also like the power of like female friendship. Yes.
I think it's like the whole thing about like, their families falling apart and them finding each other even through conflict with each other.
Yes.
That it's like,
yeah, I mean, it's like they're like so opposite and so different and it's so tense and you're just like, how are they making this work?
And at first you're like,
they do it, don't they? They just carry on.
And I feel like they're like the two perfect archetypes for women because I kind of see myself and want to be the fancy one, but then you're like,
I thought I was Grace, and then now I'm more like, but I'm actually way more like Frankie.
It's like the
I'm totally going to be that person. It's like
my yurt is parked.
Let's go and meditate. Let's go and meditate and let's do this.
I pitched a yurt in the back garden. It's so weird.
I know. I love her. Actually, Frankie is my favorite because I just think
she's just such a wild card.
She is. She's kind of amazing. And she's just kind of like, she just lets it flow.
Yeah. And I like that it's like challenging the other character who's lived her life kind of being the, what she's supposed to a little bit. In a different way. She was also a fierce woman. You're running a business. So it's
but she's kind of
too maverick.
She's very rigid in that too. Whereas like Frankie's the one that's like kind of loosens her up. But then at the same time, like Grace is the one that's like, oh man, you're a bit of an egg right now.
Like they need each other so much. They balance each other up. Yeah. Such a good show. And we digress.
We have digressed. So we should go back to the Loire. So that's the different Frankie to the one that we're drinking. But yeah, I love this wine.
I'm like, I think it's been a really interesting lineup, these four. Because I think like it already shows how insanely diverse the Loire is. That there are so many things for you to look to, like that you could spend probably months just buying from this region and still not explore everything.
Yeah, and I mean we've just scratched the surface. We haven't gone into any kind of technical info about the wines or the winery so much. But
you can Google that.
As you see, Gwen's a big supporter of homework. She came with 8 pages for this.
That I hope could absorb through osmosis, that didn't.
No, but I think the most important thing is to get out there and get tasting, because then you can discover what part that you like and what wine, like what wineries you like, what wines you like, what grape varieties you like.
Totally. And that, like, and actually, say for example, if you just realize right now that Sancerre is Sauvignon, that gives you an opportunity to explore other regions with Sauvignon. That like sometimes it's fun to see where the grape that you enjoy in one region can take you in other places, because each of these grapes in different places will have a completely new expression. And then it's nice to like explore a little bit, yeah, where else it's gone and the history, why things ended up places. Because as we know, Chenin also grows a lot in South Africa and wherever else. So there's like also the history of people and how those grapes ended up there that you can also learn about, which is sometimes even more interesting than just the grape.
I concur.
So.
So.
Before we get too wild.
We can carry on drinking.
Yes.
And thanks for tuning in again. We'll be back in 3 weeks. And until then, if you're not following us on social media, you can find us on
Twitter at juice_podcast.
And on Instagram at juice.podcast.
And otherwise, you can find Emily at Vina Lupa.
And Gwen at Gwen Douglas. And that's Gwen with a U, not with a W.
Gwen Douglas, you can find me everywhere. Yeah. So until next time, I'm Gwen Douglas.
And I'm Emily Harmon. Thanks for tuning in.
Cheers.
Cheers.